The following message was preached at Redeemer Community Church. For more information about Redeemer, visit us online at www.redeemernc.org.
Today's scripture reading comes from Ecclesiastes 2:18 through 26. I hated all my work that I labored at under the sun, because I must leave it to the one who comes after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool? Yet he will take over all my work that I labored at skillfully under the sun. This too is futile. So I began to give myself over to despair concerning all my work that I had labored at under the sun. When there is a person whose work was done with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, and he must give his portion to a person who has not worked for it, this too is futile and a great wrong. For what does a person get with all his work and all his efforts that he labors at under the sun? For all his days are filled with grief, and his occupation is sorrowful. Even at night, his mind does not rest. This too is futile. There is nothing better for a person than to eat, drink, and enjoy his work. I have seen that even this is from God's hand, because who can eat and who can enjoy life apart from him? For to the person who is pleasing in his sight, he gives wisdom, knowledge, and joy. But to the sinner, he gives the task of gathering and accumulating in order to give the one who is pleasing in God's sight. This too is futile and a pursuit of the wind. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God. You may be seated. Thanks, Jenny. One of my sons graduated from high school a few months ago, and I noticed something funny that happens at graduations. Speakers take the stage and they lie to the graduates. Right? Everyone accepts these lies and they actually cheer for the speakers as they give them. And then sometimes we even take the lies and repeat them inside the card that we give to the graduate at the graduation party. Like, so these aren't all of them, but here are a few of the common lies told at graduation. Students, you can be anything you want to be. Well, I wanted to be an NBA basketball player. But I'm 5'9" and don't have much athletic ability. It wasn't a lack of desire that kept me from the NBA. How about this one? Students, follow your dreams and everything will turn out well. So do you think all the pain and the suffering in the world is caused by students who don't follow their dreams? Right, of course not. People often dream of doing things that they have no ability or opportunity to accomplish. I heard this one multiple times when my son graduated recently. Students, what you've done here will never be forgotten. You have made a mark here. We will never forget you. So they said that. Then 600 different students walked across the stage, and I was thinking, if they're all so unforgettable, why is the person reading their name from a list? Shouldn't they just look at them and be like, I know you. I remember you. I wish high schools would invite the author of Ecclesiastes. We're going to call him the teacher. I wish they'd invite the teacher to speak at their next graduation. Like, he would not repeat these same sentimental lies. Like, he would be honest with the students. Like, he would tell them, students, your future is a bit like playing that claw game at the arcade. You know that game where you put in some coins, then there's a claw, and you're supposed to position the claw above whatever prize you want, you push the button, and what you're hoping is the claw will descend, it'll latch onto a prize, then it drops the prize in the chute where it'll come out to you. But what happens is each time the claw descends, it grabs a prize, and then each time the prize slips out before it reaches you. Students, he would say, you will spend your life trying to grab onto something you think will satisfy, and each thing you grab is going to slip through your fingers. Or maybe he would simply quote the Rolling Stones. I can't get no satisfaction. I can't get no satisfaction. Because I try and I try and I try and I try, I can't get no satisfaction. You see, the teacher doesn't play around. He doesn't pretend. He just gives the unvarnished truth. Life, he says in chapter 2, is an endless cycle of gathering and accumulating, but you don't really get to enjoy it, and then you die. I know it's not the most uplifting and encouraging speech. You probably wouldn't be invited back the next year, but it's the most honest. I mean, how many times have you said to yourself, man, once I'm able to afford that, then I'll be satisfied. Or once I finish this project, once I finish this degree, once I sort of finish this season of life, I'm going to be content. Or when I finally get married, when I finally have kids, when the kids finally move out of the house, when the kids give me grandkids, like, I won't want anything else. Or all I need to be happy is fill in the blank. But then the blank gets filled in, life moves on, and you're no more satisfied than you were before. This chapter of Ecclesiastes is fascinating because it's written like a science experiment. It's one man's attempt to methodically answer the question, what do I need to be satisfied? So he has the resources to try everything, and he will try it both in moderation and abundance. So as he tries to find contentment and he tries to find satisfaction, he keeps returning to his opening statement, life is a vapor. Yet in spite of his failure to find satisfaction, the chapter ends in a hopeful way. I think his question is the question we all ask. We're all searching for satisfaction. Like a desire to be satisfied, a desire to be happy, a desire to be content. This is what drives our decisions. This is why we say yes to certain things and no to other things. So the same desire leads one person to refuse the piece of chocolate cake and the other person to accept a second slice. Right? The one who refuses it, he's seeking satisfaction sort of in a long-term goal of health and fitness. And the one who accepts the second slice is pursuing satisfaction in immediate chocolatey goodness. Right? But it's a desire to be satisfied that drives them both. So the bulk of this chapter details all of the attempts the teacher is making to find satisfaction. And it reveals how they all fail. Like everything that he thinks he gains, he says, it slips through my fingers. I've grouped these attempts, all of his attempts, just into four unsatisfying gains. Four unsatisfying gains. Now, before we look at the unsatisfying gains, I want you to remember what we saw at the end of chapter one, that the teacher is turning our attention to King Solomon. He doesn't tell us who he is. Maybe it was Solomon, maybe not, but he wants us to think about Solomon because Solomon is the man who had it all, right? He's rich, he's famous, he's powerful, he's wise, he's successful, and he wants us to, as we think about this experiment, think about Solomon's life because no person has ever had an easier road to satisfaction than Solomon has. And so if he can't find satisfaction, what hope do we have? Like if the man who has it all, still lacks contentment. I mean, who can possibly be content? So this chapter details the teacher's scientific experiment. He says, in verse 13 of chapter 1, he says, I applied my mind to examine these things, these questions of contentment and satisfaction. So he is searching for something. If you were him, where would you look? I mean, where have you looked? What have you tried? The first place he looks is pretty obvious. He looks to pleasure. So if I keep pursuing pleasure, then will I find satisfaction? Look at verse 1. I said to myself, go ahead. I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy what is good, but it turned out to be futile. I said about laughter, it is madness. About pleasure, what does this accomplish? I explored with my mind the pull of wine on my body, my mind still guiding me with wisdom. And how to grasp folly until I could see what is good for people to do under heaven during the few days of their lives. So the world is his candy store, and he walks around like a kid who's sampling anything that grabs his attention, like, ooh, that looks tasty. I'll take one of those. And like a kid who stuffs himself with cotton candy and caramel apples and jelly beans, everything that tasted good now leaves him empty and miserable. Now, one particular pleasure he focuses on is laughter, right? Laughter, after all, is the best medicine. But after laughing his ways through weeks and months, he comes to the conclusion that laughter is madness. Because the only person who laughs all the time is the lunatic who's locked in the asylum, right? Our world is full of difficulties and frustrations that make constant laughter feel ridiculous. Like, there are certain situations in life, this is what parents teach their kids, where you should not laugh, right? Where laughter is out of place. Now, sometimes it's funny when someone laughs in those situations, but there are certain times where if you're laughing, everyone looks at you and says, what's wrong with them? And so when he finally stops laughing, he asks himself, what did this accomplish? Laughter's like whipped cream, right? It's really good on a piece of pie, but if it's the main course, you're going to leave the table feeling empty. The next pleasure he experienced with, verse 3, is wine. Now, he doesn't tell us much about this experiment, other than that it was intentional. He didn't lose his wits. So maybe he was a connoisseur of fine wines, like that person, who swirls the rind in their glass and smells it and talks about sort of the oaky things underneath it. I don't even know what the terminology is. He's that guy, though. Or maybe he's a guy who just goes to the pub and gets drunk with friends. Maybe he tried both ways, but he says none of it satisfied him. Now, his thinking behind trying wine is the thinking behind other forms of self-medication. Here's the question he's asking: can I put something into my body which will help me reach a point where I will feel satisfied? Right? So this is the same question being asked by the person who smokes weed or the person who takes too much medication, right? And the reason they call it a high is because eventually you have to come down. And so his conclusion here is that the constant pursuit of pleasure still leaves a person unsatisfied. In fact, the more you try to hold on to pleasure, the less successful you'll be. That pleasure is like a cloud. It drifts away. Next, he looks for gain in a place that's common in American culture. So he looks to the accumulation of possessions. If I acquire the right amount of things, then will this make me satisfied? So he begins with an attempt to recreate the Garden of Eden for himself. Verse 4, he says, I increased my achievements. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made gardens and parks for myself and planted every kind of fruit tree in them. I constructed reservoirs for myself from which to irrigate a grove of flourishing trees. So here he is. He's cultivating creation. He's attempting to restore the beauty that it had prior to mankind's rebellion against God. So he plants these multiple gardens, fills them with fruit trees. He makes sure they're irrigated by these reservoirs. During the day, he's able to sort of stroll through and soak in the beauty of his gardens, and then he's able to feast at night on all the bounty they provide. Now, this type of creating and maintaining of gardens is too much for one man, and so it says he accumulates servants and slaves to care for his land and his livestock. So he is this man of great power. He's a man of great authority. In fact, he says he's amassed more wealth than is possible to spend in one lifetime. Nations pay him tribute. There's nothing that he lacks that he doesn't have the resources to buy. Can you imagine never once having said the phrase, I can't afford it? Well, that's him. Look at verse 7. I acquired male and female servants and had slaves who were born in my house. I also owned livestock, large herds and flocks, more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. I also amassed silver and gold for myself and the treasure of kings and provinces. I gathered male and female singers for myself and many concubines, the delights of men. So if the American dream is to own your own land, to own your own house, to have people working for you, and money in the bank to provide for your future, then he has fulfilled it. But he doesn't stop with owning land or having servants or vaults flush with gold. He turns to more sensual pleasures. He turns to music and sex. His houses are constantly filled with the sound of live music. Imagine having your favorite band on retainer. So you sit down, you make your Pop-Tart, and your favorite band's playing a concert for you anytime you want. This is his life. Right? The best musicians in the land, they're fighting for the opportunity to play concerts for them. And his life is filled with women, exotic and beautiful. We're supposed to think of Solomon. And we know that Solomon had a personal harem of 1,000 women from multiple different nations. So here he is, sex, concerts, food, houses, servants, gardens. And where does this leave him? Certainly having all of these possessions, all of these pleasures that he has gained, this has finally brought him satisfaction, right? Verse 9. So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. My wisdom also remained with me. All that my eyes desired, I did not deny them. I did not refuse myself any pleasures, but I took pleasure in all my struggles. This was my reward for all my struggles. When I considered all that I accomplished and what I had labored to achieve, I found everything to be futile in a pursuit of the wind. There was nothing to be gained under the sun. So all of his possessions, all of his attempts at pleasure are empty peanut butter jars. Right? He has not been able to gain the one thing that eludes him. He has no satisfaction. So what he says here in verses 9 through 11, it reminds me a lot of a statement Tom Brady made on 60 Minutes, right after he won his third Super Bowl. He said this, he said, "Why do I have three Super Bowl rings and still think there's something greater out there for me?" I mean, maybe a lot of people would say, "Hey man, this is what it is. I reached my goal, my dream, my life is." Well, me, I think, God, it's got to be more than this. I mean, this can't be all it's cracked up to be. I mean, I've done it. I'm 27, and what else is there for me? What's the answer? The interviewer asks him. And Brady responds, "I wish I knew. I wish I knew." See, everything eventually that we think will bring us satisfaction, if we can just get a good grip on it, eventually slips through our fingers, and we're left asking, what else is there? What else is there? So now the teacher turns a different direction to see if he can gain satisfaction. So he stops looking outward, and he begins to look inward. If pleasure and possessions can't do it, maybe something spiritual, something to do with his heart and mind. Could wisdom be the answer to his question? If he gained wisdom, would he find satisfaction? Well, he immediately determines that wisdom has value. So he compares having wisdom to walking in the light. The person who lacks wisdom is like the miner who doesn't charge his flashlight before entering the mine shaft. Right? Wisdom is the floodlight that illuminates the path ahead. He says in verse 12, "Then I turned to consider wisdom, madness, and folly. For what will the king's successor be like? He will do what has already been done." And I realize there is an advantage to wisdom over folly, like the advantage of light over darkness. The wise person has eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And so he's like, he concludes, life is certainly better for the person with wisdom because foolishness brings sort of this constant irritation of stubbing your toe and banging your forehead because you're wandering around in the dark. So since wisdom is clearly better than foolishness, maybe wisdom can bring satisfaction. Verse 14. "Yet I also knew that one fate comes to them both. So I said to myself, what happens to the fool will also happen to me. Why then have I been overly wise? And I said to myself that this also is futile, for just like the fool, there's no lasting remembrance of the wise, since in the days to come both will be forgotten. How is it that the wise person dies just like the fool? Therefore I hated life, because the work that was done under the sun was distressing to me, for everything is futile and a pursuit of the wind." Here's what he says, like, wisdom is great, but then sages die too. Like, the wisest person isn't able to stop the ticking of the clock. Like, what difference, the teacher asks, does it make whether your car is immaculate or covered in dents if it's going to end up in the junkyard either way? I think these verses are the answer to the person who thinks that a certain brand of spirituality, zeal for a specific religion or adhering to a particular philosophy, that this will somehow gain them what they're missing. So if the first 11 verses describe the search for meaning by pursuing the American dream, then verses 12 through 17 describe the search for meaning by rejecting material pursuits. In my community group this week, Murali described these verses, I like this, as the person who spends 2 years in the Himalayas searching for enlightenment. Like, I've tried all the world has to offer, now I'm just going to retreat. I'm going to find enlightenment. And they come back no different. See, satisfaction doesn't come through the constant accumulation of possessions and pleasure, but satisfaction also doesn't come by rejecting all possessions and pleasure. In fact, you could argue that the time of Solomon, the time we're directing our mind toward, is the pinnacle of Jewish civilization, the apex of Jewish worship, right? The temple that Solomon builds for the worship of the true God, it is unmatched in terms of beauty and transcendence, and yet Solomon still isn't able to find what he's searching for. For all his gains, satisfaction still slips through his fingers. Because death levels the playing field between the wise and the fool. Both the wise and the fool die, verse 16, and they are both forgotten. And this leads the teacher to a bold and shocking statement. He says in verse 17, therefore, I hated life. Therefore, I hated life. Right? Nothing he has gained has satisfied him, and it leaves him feeling empty. Right? What he's done is he's wrapped his arms over one thing after another, and he's convinced each time, like, oh, this is it. This is what I'm finally missing. And each time, as he wraps his arms around it, it slips through his fingers. And now he realizes that even if somehow he were able to hold on to this thing for a while, that death is going to loosen his grip permanently. That nothing he gains is going to be with him forever. Does his honesty surprise you? I mean, does his admission, I hated life, make you uncomfortable? And if you sat down with a friend for coffee, you said, how are you doing? They say, I hate life. It's a bit startling. Oh, we're going there. Like, because we don't like to think about these things. Right? The raw, blunt admission that he is fed up with everything he's tried and his life is miserable and unsatisfying. This is not the type of thing we're used to hearing. The French philosopher Blaise Pascal, he could have easily been talking about the teacher or talking about us when he said this. He said, as men have not been able to cure death, misery, or ignorance, they have taken to not thinking about them so as to become happy. I mean, does that describe you? Do you try to keep yourself happy by not thinking about these things? By not asking real questions? Do you keep the volume up loud enough? Do you keep yourself running so fast? Do you keep your calendar so full that it drowns out the cries of your own heart? Like wisdom, just like pleasures and possession, cannot bring lasting satisfaction. So he turns one more direction. This time, he's going to gain what will satisfy him. He throws himself into his work. But here's the reality. He's already been thinking about death. And so he can't shake the fact that whatever he builds, whatever he accomplishes in his life is going to be left to others, and then some fool is going to destroy everything he spent his life building. Verse 18, I hated all my work that I labored at under the sun, because I must leave it to the one who comes after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool, yet he will take over all my work that I labored at skillfully under the sun. This too is futile. So I began to give myself over to despair concerning all my work that I had labored at under the sun. When there is a person whose work was done with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, and he must give his portion to a person who has not worked for it, this too is futile and a great wrong. For what does a person get with all his work and all his efforts that he labors at under the sun? For all his days are filled with grief, and his occupation is sorrowful. Even at night his mind does not rest, this too is futile. Your job can be such a big part of your identity, right? This is why we so often, when we're meeting someone, pretty quickly ask, so what do you do? We like to define ourselves by our accomplishments, whether that's accomplishment at work or accomplishment in other responsibilities. Maybe it's the responsibilities you have at home, right? We think, well, if I'm just a diligent parent, right, then I'll be satisfied. If I'm a faithful spouse, then I'll be content. If we just accomplish our goals, and we accomplish them in a way that makes us secure for the future, then finally we'll feel like we've made it. But this too is empty. And so the teacher returns again to the question he opened with in chapter 1. Verse 22, he asks, what does a person gain by all his efforts? What does a person gain by all his efforts? Like, this is a question I challenged you to think about last week. I hope you have this week. Have you asked, what have I gained by all my efforts? Is my life's work just a collection of empty peanut butter jars? Something I think is in there, something that will last and it's empty? The question that drove Mitch Albom to spend all those days, all those Tuesdays with Maury, his dying college professor, is very similar. So Mitch asked himself this. He said, what happened to me? I once promised myself I would never work for money, that I would join the Peace Corps, that I would live in beautiful, inspirational places. Instead, I've been in Detroit for 10 years now. At the same workplace, using the same bank, visiting the same barber. I was 37, more efficient than in college, tied to computers and modems and cell phones. I wrote articles about rich athletes who, for the most part, could not care less about people like me. I was no longer young for my peer group, nor did I walk around in gray sweatshirts with unlit cigarettes in my mouth. I did not have long discussions over egg salad sandwiches about the meaning of life. My days were full, yet I remained much of the time unsatisfied. I think that's a pretty good summary of the teacher's experience. My days were full, yet I remained unsatisfied. Have you felt the same thing? Have you felt like everything that you were convinced would bring you satisfaction keeps slipping through your fingers? Like every time you're reaching for that thing and you're like, this is it, this is the one I really need, and your hands come up empty. Like nothing you have gained makes up for what you're missing. Now, pleasure and possessions, wisdom and work, these aren't the only unsatisfying gains, but they're some of the most prominent. And you can throw anything else in there. You can add to that list in any way you want, and the outcome's the same. But thankfully, that's not where the chapter ends. It ends with the teacher telling us about some satisfying gifts. This feels sort of like the first positive turn here in the book, the end of chapter 2. And we'll see similar turns throughout the book. But in verses 24 and 25, the teacher talks about satisfaction, contentment, and joy. And then in verse 26, he contrasts two types of people. He says this in verse 24, "There's nothing better for a person than to eat, drink, and enjoy his work. I've seen that even this is from God's hand, because who can eat and who can enjoy life apart from him? For to the person who is pleasing in his sight, he gives wisdom, knowledge, and joy. But to the sinner, he gives the task of gathering and accumulating in order to give to the one who is pleasing in God's sight. This too is futile and a pursuit of the wind." What he says here is there is a way to live that brings satisfaction. Like there is a way of enjoying the good gifts that God gives to his people without the fear of losing them. And we can understand the difference in the two ways of living by comparing two words. There's this one word he's used over and over throughout the first two chapters, and that's the word gain. And there's a word he used in verse 26, which is the word gives. So if you live your whole life trying to gain something that will satisfy you, you will fail. But if you can look at everything in your life as something that God gives you, then you're on the road that leads to contentment and satisfaction. So in verse 26, this sort of unsatisfying way of gaining is described as the task of gathering and accumulating. I mean, let's be honest. Isn't that how we often look at life? You're going to go to work this week. Why? To gather and accumulate. Gathering a paycheck, gathering vacation time, gathering, you're going to go on a trip, you're going to gather some experiences, some pleasures. It's this task of gathering things that we think will satisfy us. And so we're desperately trying to accumulate that which we think, if I just get this, now I'll be content, I'll be satisfied, I'll be joyful, I'll be secure. And it not only leads to frustration and emptiness, but it leads to the judgment of God. Right? Because the constant, unending drive to gather and accumulate for ourselves is the mark of a sinner. Verse 26. And verse 25, it's doing all of this effort apart from God. But the teacher shows us this different way to live. It's the way of Jesus. It's the way, verse 25, that pleases God. So standing next to the well, Jesus compared these two ways of living using a metaphor of water. Right? And so he talks about that first way, the way of gaining. And he says the way of gaining, it's like you're putting your bucket down the well and you're doing the work to lower it, to gather the water, to gain it, and then you pull it back up, all that work because you're thirsty, and you take a drink from the bucket and you feel great, and a few minutes later, you're thirsty again. And that bucket gets empty and you start the process again. Another bucket. Maybe if I gain this water, then I'll be satisfied. But you keep You keep finding yourself thirsty. In fact, the woman that he was speaking to at the well, she was attempting to quench this thirst inside her with relationships. Just like one more relationship, and she'd get that relationship. She'd be like, oh, this is the one. Now I'm content. Now I'm satisfied. And then she'd get thirsty again. Every time she thought she gained what she needed, she found herself thirsty again. But there is a different type of water. It's the water that is Jesus himself. And when we receive the gift of Jesus, we never need to thirst again. But it's a gift that we receive not by our effort, not by earning it, not by straining for it. It's a gift we receive by faith, right? Without faith, it is impossible to please God. So the one who pleases God is the one who receives Jesus by faith. And listen, it's the gift of Jesus that allows us to enjoy all of the other gifts that God gives us. See, Jesus tells the woman at the well what the teacher is saying here, that satisfaction is possible, but it's not by setting our focus and attention, setting our goals on what we can gain in this world. We can never gain enough to be satisfied. But there is a way of faith that receives the good gifts that God has given us through Jesus, and it brings a satisfaction that actually outlasts death. Right? So the sacrifice of Jesus in our place is the gift from God that leads to all of God's other gifts. And it's a gift which, unlike wisdom, and unlike possessions, and unlike pleasure, and unlike work, outlasts death itself. A right relationship with God through Jesus. I mean, that's what it means when it says a person that pleases God. There's only one way to please God, and that is to come to him in faith through Jesus. The one who pleases God, this type of right relationship, it allows us to then receive the good gifts he gives us and experience contentment. Right? Because, listen, this is the key, I think, because the gifts are no longer necessary, the pressure to hold on to them is released. Like, we can finally enjoy what God has given us because we don't need it. Like Job, who had everything, and then everything was taken away, we can say, the Lord gives, and the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. If I have Jesus and nothing else, I have everything. But if I have everything else and not Jesus, I have nothing. You see, the gospel is paradoxical to our way of thinking. Like, Jesus says these things that seem so backward to us. He says to his disciples, the way up is you need to go down. The way to glory is through suffering. The way to life is through death. And here we see that the way to find satisfaction is to stop trying to gain satisfaction in all the ways we try to gain satisfaction. That the tighter we hold on to the things around us, the less satisfying they will be. I taught my sons how to shoot a basketball. I've taught some others. And I teach them this, that if you want to make a shot, you cannot grip the basketball tightly. Like, the tighter you grip a basketball, the less chance of making it. In fact, if you go there and you grip it super tight and you shoot, you'll probably miss everything. In order to make it work, you have to grip it loosely. And the same is true of life. Like, the tighter you hold to anything in your life, I must have this. I must hold on to this. I cannot let this go. The less joy you'll find in it. It's fascinating to me that the satisfying gifts that he lists in verse 24 are eating, drinking, and working. Now, this is not sort of the hedonistic eat, drink, and be merry for tomorrow we may die. That's not at all what he's saying. These are the gifts that were given to Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. Right? They ate, they drank, and they worked in God's presence, and it was satisfying. And it was only when they attempted to do it apart from God that they were dissatisfied. And so Jesus came, and he came to restore us to God, to lead us back in the garden. And so he says, through Jesus now, you can do what Adam and Eve failed to do. You can eat, and you can drink, and you can work in my presence in a way that will actually satisfy you. So what if work wasn't something you feared or something you loathed, like, oh, it's Monday again, I gotta go, or something you lived for, but you actually saw your work as a gift from God, and God gave it to you both to enjoy and to steward for as long as he leaves it in your hands. See, this is the perspective Jesus produces in his people. When we find our identity and we find our purpose in who Jesus says we are, not in our success or failure at work, then we're able to approach work as a gift from him. So we can do it with joy, we can do it with contentment until he takes it away, because our work doesn't define us. If we lose our job, we have not lost everything, right? Because the Lord gives and the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. What if we looked at everything through the lens of this is a gift from God to me, and I'm going to enjoy this gift, I'm going to appreciate this gift as long as it lasts, but I'm not going to try to hold on to it. I mean, I wonder how much joy you forfeit because instead of enjoying what God gives you, you're trying to hold on to it. So in the middle of something that should be enjoyable, you can't enjoy it because you're wondering, when do I get to do it again? What if I lose it? What if it ends? And so you're so afraid of losing it, you're so focused on it that you don't actually ever enjoy it. And we're a lot like the crowds that followed Jesus. And Jesus miraculously provides bread for them. In fact, he provides so much more, there's leftovers. There's a lesson in that. And instead of saying, like, wow, this is awesome, and listening as Jesus says, well, this is just a sign of what I can do for you. I can provide for you something that the hunger in your heart can finally be stilled. Instead of listening to that, they start pestering Jesus. When do we get bread again? I mean, how often is that us? That God in his kindness gives us a pleasure and he provides us with a job and all of these things. And instead of enjoying them as these good gifts from God, we're worried about losing them. We're holding on to them. We're trying to grab them and we're missing what God has intended for us. Brothers and sisters, the prophet Isaiah, near the end of his book, he shares this promise from God about the work of Jesus. And I'm going to read it in just a second, but I want you to think about the terminology used and how similar it is to this chapter of Ecclesiastes 2. And what his promise is, it's a promise fully fulfilled in the return of Christ, but it's one that, as his people united with him, we get to experience now. We start to experience this. But listen to the description and compare it just in your minds with what we read from the teacher in chapter 2. God says this in Isaiah 65, people will build houses and live in them. They will plant vineyards and eat their fruit. They will not build and others live in them. They will not plant and others eat. For my people's lives will be like the lifetime of a tree. My chosen ones will fully enjoy the work of their hands. They will not labor without success or bear children destined for disaster, for they will be a people blessed by the Lord along with their descendants. Here's what God is saying, that when his son comes, that everything changes. And we can start to enjoy his gifts again because we have been brought into right relationship with him. Eric Liddell was a missionary to China who died in a Japanese internment camp during World War II. But before Eric was a missionary, he was a runner. In the 1924 Olympics, Eric was the favorite to win the 100-meter dash. but he actually refused to run the race because it was being held on a Sunday. And he felt that he needed to be worshiping the Lord. I need to be gathering with the people of God instead of being in the race. And people were shocked and dismayed by his decision. Like, how can you possibly give up a chance to win an Olympic gold medal? You might never get another chance. But Liddell understood that his life was not going to be defined by what happened on the track. Right? That gaining an Olympic medal, as awesome as that would be, would not satisfy him. So because running did not define him, and because his ultimate prize was not winning a gold medal, what you see is that he doesn't give up running. He actually finds joy in running. So in Chariots of Fire, which is the movie based on his life, his character captures the truth of Ecclesiastes 2. He says this, "I believe God made me for a purpose, but he also made me fast. And when I run, I feel his pleasure. To give that up would be to hold him in contempt." And what he's saying is this, because God made me for a purpose, I'm to be found in Christ. Then I can do these other things he gives me as gifts. I can do them with joy and satisfaction and contentment because I know they please him and I feel his pleasure. Like he could run not because he had to run fast to gain something. He could run because God made him fast. And when he ran fast, he felt joy and he felt God's joy in him. Have you learned this lesson? Or are you still trying to gain satisfaction in all your pursuits? Let me just say, if you are, they will slip through your fingers. Only satisfaction found in Christ allows us to enjoy the good gifts he gives us. Will you pray with me? Father, I do pray that you'll help us to think about these things. I know our temptation, my temptation too, is to leave and then forget about what we've talked about. And I pray that you'll help us to think honestly about what we've talked about. To ask ourselves these questions, what have I gained for all my work? What am I trying to gain from all my work? Am I trying to get something from there that cannot deliver? Or am I reaching for one thing after another, thinking it's what I need for this reason or for that reason, and it keeps coming up empty, so I try again with something new? But I pray that you help us to see this, and I pray that you'll help us in our questions to turn to Jesus, to drink the water, which is Christ himself, and then find in him joy that we never experienced before. Lord, you are glorified when we find our joy in you, when we feel your pleasure, that you are pleased with us, not because we're trying to gain from your gifts, but because we're enjoying your gifts as a token of your grace and your kindness to us. So, Lord, I pray that we'll be a people filled with joy and contentment and satisfaction because we're not searching for it in all the things around us, but we found it in Christ. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.
Thank you for listening to this message from Redeemer Community Church in Fuquay-Varina, North Carolina. Feel free to make copies of this message to give to others, but please do not charge for those copies or alter the content in any way without permission. For more sermons, we invite you to visit us online at redeemernc.org.